Welcome to the current federal tax developments for the week of December the 11th, 2017. Current federal tax developments, as always, are brought to you by the Lascalzo Institute, a Kaplan company, and your state society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers, and I'm broadcasting here this week back in Phoenix after being on the road for a while. Just got back in from being in Albuquerque, New Mexico for their tax conference and heading back out on the road tomorrow, Sunday morning. I'm recording this on Saturday. So it's an interesting week, but things have continued to happen. This week, we're going to talk briefly about what's going on in the tax bill. This was a week where we formed conference committees, and we got some more reports about the things that they are considering making changes when they go to a final conference bill. We'll talk about an IRS memo that clarified the tax treatment of a disgorgement payment following a United States Supreme Court decision on the topic. We'll talk about the IRS issuance of the Qualified Plan Required Amendment List, which was published for 2017 this week. We'll have a problem with a taxpayer who attempted to sell property to his former spouse. And that's fine, but the problem was that he attempted to claim a tax loss for this. Turns out that didn't work for him. And we'll also talk about a case where a taxpayer tried to claim that the IRS had discovered a rather significant error on their tax return by conducting an impermissible second examination of their books and records. We'll tell you about why the tax court did not agree that there had been such an impermissible second look at their books and records. Let's first turn to the bill we've been talking about for a while here now, the past few weeks, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, H.R. 1. This week, a couple of things happened. The House appointed its committee members on the 4th of December. The Senate followed along on the 6th with its members. Now, as a practical matter, the conference committee is probably not where you need to watch for the real negotiations on this bill, because as the ranking Democratic senator said, the conference is effectively for show. What he meant by that was that because, you know, this bill is, and we all know, it's going to be passed with solely Republican votes, that in reality, the big issue here is, you know, what the agreement is among the Republican leadership on the House and Senate about how this bill will move through. So, you know, there will be conference meetings, but in reality, the real negotiations going on in a little different location. But nevertheless, we now officially are under the process. Now, it was reported this morning that the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee was suggesting, or I should say, the House Majority Leader, was suggesting that there would not be a vote in the coming week. That is, you know, this is all, the House is not going to vote on the final bill in this upcoming week. The idea is that there is a rough deadline date of December the 22nd to get all this done, because that is when the continuing resolution dies again, and the House and Senate have to take up the issue of funding the government. So the idea is they want to get this done before that deadline so they can take that up. And because of that, probably we're looking that, you know, not this week, but the following week, if they stay on schedule, for when we'll actually get the final bill. That may leave us just a little over a week to do any tax planning that might be needed. Now, some of the key issues still under negotiation. Yeah, they've now kind of figured out that AMT add back that the Senate put in their bill at the last minute. The corporate AMT is a problem. And so they are going to try to address that and figure out how to unwind that problem. If you're not aware what that problem was, the corporate AMT was put back in the bill by the Senate to raise money. The problem is that today the corporate AMT is at a 20% rate and the top corporate rate is 35%. No big problem. However, when you make the top corporate rate 20%, suddenly if you have an AMT at 20%, things don't work very well. And they're just now kind of figuring that out. Effectively, that'd be a backdoor repeal of a whole bunch of tax benefits that are not allowed for AMT purposes. They would just effectively be not allowed for a corporation. So they're going to work on that. There has been a lot of discussion this week about finding a way to modify the tax deduction, potentially to allow state and local income taxes to be used instead of real estate taxes electively. For the $10,000, maybe even sales taxes would be in there as an option instead of the, you know, you're part of the $10,000. Maybe you could do all of them. We just cap them at $10,000. Maybe the number goes up. The reason why that's important is because a number of congressmen, especially those from California that voted for the bill when it came out of the House, did so on the assumption that this was going to be, shall we say, made less onerous for their constituents when the final bill came through. Now they're calling in that card. So we'll see how that goes. That's primarily an issue to get this through the House, because as we've discussed before, the Senate doesn't really care as much about this issue because most of the senators, the high tax states in question, do not have Republican senators. So therefore, it's not necessary to get it through the Senate, but they do have a lot of House members, and that's why the House has a bigger problem with this. We also are still waiting, and this you're not going to find as much coverage of in the press as to which way they're going, but it's going to be key to figure out how they actually go through pass-through taxation. That is, are they going to go the Senate's route or the House's route? Now, most observers seem to be betting these days that they'll go the Senate route because that is a whole lot simpler to work. But whether they keep the percentages of the Senate, how they work with it, whole lots of issues are around, so keep your eye on those. Again, all of this we're going to have to figure out when we actually get a House bill. A conference bill. One thing that can be useful for you right now, and again, you know, your clients want you to tell them something. The Joint Committee on Taxation did release a report. It's on their website, report JCX-64-17, which actually details, you know, what is in both bills, what things are in both bills but with different terms, and what things are just in one bill. That kind of a worksheet can help you figure out, you know, if something's in both bills with the same terms, there's a real good chance as long as we get a bill, that's how it's going to work. If it's in both bills but it has different terms, you know, or maybe different percentages, then we figure there's going to be some compromise, but we're probably going to see that. Things that are just in one bill or the other, those are the kinds of things that may simply go away when we end up with a conference bill. So, you know, you can get some feel. You can't really prove anything because some of those things in only one bill are going to make it to the final bill. And some things that aren't in anything right now may very well end up in the final bill. We just don't know. But this Joint Committee report can certainly be useful for the moment to kind of let you wrap your heads around, well, what does it appear they've agreed upon and what things really seem to be up in the air? And can help because your clients, of course, now are trying to do their year-end tax planning. And our big problem is we have no idea what 2018's tax law is going to look like yet. Now let's start with our first development of the week. This is an IRS memo that was issued on the 1st of December, Chief Counsel Advice 2017-48008. And this deals with disgorgement payments for federal security laws violations. In various situations, if you violate federal security laws, you may be required to return the profits. In various sense. So you may be required to give up those profits. It could go into a fund that will maybe be used to pay those who were victimized by your bad actions. You know, various structures may be done. The question becomes, though, is that a penalty? And that's important because, you know, Section 162F bars a deduction for a fine or a penalty. The Supreme Court recently ruled in a case that related to the disgorgement rules regarding violations of federal security laws. This was Kokesh versus the SEC that came down from the Supreme Court this year. This memo considers how the IRS should handle payments under the disgorgement statute that was covered in Kokesh, given how the Supreme Court interpreted the statute in their case. The question became, is it going to be this fine or similar penalty? Are these items non-deductible, or do they represent simply, you know, a return of money, you know, giving money back to somebody else and represent a deductible item? You know, basically it was just a loss on a transaction. And what this memo concludes is it has a discussion, and even if you don't ever deal with this area, it's a nice discussion of what is a fine or penalty. Now, and they note very simply, it does not need to be criminal. That's not the question. What the question they said consistently, and they said, and Kokesh pushes this point, it was Kokesh dealt with a different issue of, you know, whether this was a penalty or not. But the question they said comes down to, is this a payment that is meant to discourage future actions by the party that was ordered to pay it? The IRS concluded in this case, this disgorgement payment was intentionally in the law to discourage people from doing these bad actions. Because they were intended to discourage people from doing the bad actions, the disgorgement payments are not deductible when they are paid by the taxpayer. Since it serves to deter future behavior, and that's the point of the payment, The IRS position is any payment that is meant to deter future behavior is going to run afoul of Section 162F. Next up, those of you who work with qualified retirement plans, the IRS issued what's going to become an annual notice. This is Notice 2017-72, issued on December 5th. This is the list of required amendments for 2017 published by the IRS. Qualified retirement plans, things like profit sharing plans, 401k plans, defined benefit pension plans, cash balance plans, these plans have to be set up with terms that agree with the law. If the law changes, then the plan has to be amended. Those changes could come from changes in regulations. They could come from changes in actual code that is passed by Congress. Now, because, you know, these changes don't happen instantaneously, IRS needs to issue guidance, lots of things happen. The IRS has set up procedures that are used to modify these plans. Now, this is for manually, individually designed plans. That is, ones where you're submitting it on your own. You're not adopting a prototype plan or something of that sort. These are the ones that are looking at amendments on this area. Large entities probably are adopting mainly these customized plans that you'd be doing. Now, the RA has various rules, and the catch here is, they tell you in 2017 those items that need to be amended, right? What has happened in 2017 that's going to require amendment? When they publish that list of amendments, then things they think is ready for amendment, the plan has 2 years. So even though this is the list of required amendments for 2017, you know, you might be thinking, well, how can you do that? You publish it December 5th. We have to get this done the next few days. No, you've got 2 years. These are the ones by December 31st, 2019 will have to be done. Now, the IRS only lists two items, one which related to cash balance and hybrid plans, and then we've got benefit restrictions for certain defined benefit plans that are eligible cooperative plans or charity plans. Those are the two they say that are general. If you have a plan that is of that type, you're going to probably need to amend the plan. And those are the only two general ones they have. Then they have a specific plan amendment they think is more limited. This deals with final regulations regarding partial annuity distribution options for defined benefit plans. If you have those options or you're using those options, then you have to amend your plan. You've got till 19 to get that done. Now, you still operate the plans because all of these requirements are current law as if the plan had been amended, but your actual amendment has to be in place by the end of 2019. So because of that, we get this list published. This is the 2017. They didn't used to work it this way. This is the way we're now working these things. There used to be on, like, you know, cycles. It went for a few years, and your plan was on cycles, and it updated whenever its cycle year came. Now everybody's going to be on the same structure. We're just going to every year tell you what you're going to be doing 2 years from now. And so you've got 2 years to get that amendment in place. And obviously, the end of 18, you'll get another list of things that you have to get amended before 2 years are up, if it affects your plan. Let's take a look at a case next. The next one coming up is the case of Stapleton, versus Commissioner, Tax Court Summary Opinion 2017-87. This was issued on December the 4th of 2017. This deals with transfers of property that are pursuant to a divorce. General rule under Section 1041, if there's any transfers between husband and wife, those transfers do not generate gain or loss. So you can't generate a loss on property. Let's say that I was to own property that had a loss on it right now. I couldn't sell that property to my wife, even if we're filing separate returns, and take that loss on my return. As well, if I sold it to my wife and it has a gain, there's no gain on my return either. 1041 says we ignore that. It also has a secondary part of it, which deals with divorce, because, you know, at the end in divorce, quite often we have transfers. In this case, the same rule applies to any transfer to a former spouse, but only if the transfer is incident to the divorce. This case involves a question of whether a transfer, was incident to a divorce. This couple got divorced. And at the time of the divorce, they owned a piece of property. The piece of property was technically titled in the husband's name at the end of the divorce. But there were requirements that, you know, he had to pay certain expenses related to the property. His wife had to pay certain expenses related to the property. His wife was a realtor. But so he had to list the property for sale through her. She had to, you know, it was going to be at a certain price. If it didn't sell at the end of a year at that price, we would reduce the price. We also had a rule that says if somebody offered within a certain percentage of that price, he had to accept it. Now, all this was going on right at the real estate crisis. So what happened was the value of this property was considerably less than they had paid for it. And it turns out apparently considerably less than they were asking for to sell it. And they had quite a big mortgage on it. That's part of the reason for this problem. So they continued to attempt to sell this thing for a few years. They kept knocking it down. And, you know, per the agreement, it went down per the schedule, still could not get a sale on it. Finally, the husband turned to his former wife, and he said, you know, look, I've tried to sell this property. We can't get it done. Would you just go ahead and buy it from me? So she paid him, you know, the equity was, you know, it, for this property, it was 100-some thousand, but this property was double seven-figure property, so relatively minor amount, and she took on the debt, which was not insignificant. And so she got ownership of the property. He therefore recorded that as a sale on his return. He took the position that since he had received the property in the divorce, this was simply a sale to now an unrelated third party. The IRS said, no, we think this is really incident to the divorce. And the tax court agreed with the IRS. They said, effectively, this is one of those things of, would we have ever had this sale going on? The answer is, it was trying to complete the property settlement, which clearly this was an odd arrangement they had with each other that was there intentionally to allow this property to be sold and to finalize the division of the assets. When they decided that it wasn't going to sell, so they decided to take a second attempt to get to the same point. So that sale from him to his former spouse did not generate a deductible loss. That sale, in the court's view, was simply the completion of the division of the property. This answer is actually good news for the wife, because from her standpoint now, this property comes to her with the entire basis intact. So she doesn't have to take the basis of what she paid, which would have been the debt plus her, you know, $100-some thousand worth of equity she paid, but rather she gets to keep the entire basis of the property. So if it were to recover in value, when she sells it, she'll be able to claim, you know, either a reduced gain or basically claim a loss without worrying about having to reset it to the value on the date of the transfer. The key thing to watch this is, you know, you have to be careful whenever you have any sort of transaction with a former spouse. You got to be very careful about recognition of gain or loss. There are some guidelines in the regulation that talk to you about, you know, if you have kind of a 6-year assumed window, if it's during that time, we assume it is related to the divorce. If it's outside that time, we assume it isn't. But you can show, and the IRS could show after that point, they could argue after that point it's related to the cessation of the marriage if they can find a linkage. And the same way you could try to prove it wasn't related to it if it's within that window. But you do need to be careful and tell your clients, you know, to kind of watch this when they do something of this sort. Anytime you have transfers with the former spouse, you know, especially when it's property like it would be in this case. In fact, this is the problem. It's property that was owned by both of you when you used to be married. There's a very good chance if you sell that to the other party, the court might decide the same as this, especially if the idea was we're going to try to sell this to somebody else, and then finally one of you just agrees to take the property. That's kind of how the court views it. Next up this week, let's talk about the case of Planty versus Commissioner. The Planty case, which is going to be our last case to discuss this week, it is Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2017-240. This case came down on December the 5th of 2017. And the taxpayer probably should have left well enough alone. What happened in this case is the IRS had been examining this taxpayer. The case doesn't tell us for sure what the issue was that caused the problem, But it appears that this exam kind of went sloppy, and the IRS may not have, you know, actually done it quite as well as they should have. Things kind of fell through, but they finally got an exam report. The taxpayer agreed to the exam report, and, you know, basically it looks like everything's ready to go. However, shortly after they signed agreeing to the report, they prepared and submitted an amended tax return, claiming a refund was now due to them. Okay, so we have an accepted exam report. The IRS is finished. They've accepted the return. The taxpayer now files an amended return, claims we're owed an additional refund. The IRS agent that was looking at it, that ended up with this amended return, decided that, well, we should really treat this as essentially a, you know, kind of a request to, you know, kind of re-examine, reconsider, audit reconsideration request. You know, that they're saying, obviously they're saying that the audit got it wrong. So we're not going to treat this as a claim for refund at the moment. We're just going to treat it as a request for audit reconsideration. So he got the audit file. And he went through the audit file, examined it. He eventually determined that what they were claiming a refund on was not actually correct. They didn't have a right. It was related to withholdings of various sorts. So he determined that that wasn't justified. But while going through this his paperwork there on the exam, he noticed and, you know, kind of wondered about, they had claimed $147,000, $135 real estate loss on their return from real estate transactions. And he was thinking that, you know, really, that should have been a passive transaction. That was a passive activity, and it wasn't a complete disposition. So he said, you know, that refund bit, that theory doesn't work. But oh, by the way, I noticed this $147,000 passive loss that you should not have been allowed to claim in that year, but we had allowed you to claim it. We hadn't raised it on the exam. But since I'm back in the file, I think I'm going to raise that. Now, the taxpayer screamed, wait, foul. You had finished the exam, and, you know, there's a law against this. And they're saying Internal Revenue Code Section 7605B says that no taxpayer shall be subjected to an unnecessary examination or investigations, and only one inspection of a taxpayer's books of account shall be made for each taxable year, unless the taxpayer requests otherwise, or unless the secretary, after investigation, notifies the taxpayer in writing that additional inspection is necessary. They're saying, you know, we never requested you to look at those books, you know, to look at our books. Come look at our books. And so you shouldn't be able to reopen this exam once it's done and assess us additional tax. You know, bad for you, IRS. You missed this on the exam, but you've only got one swing at this thing. The tax court said, we don't think that's quite how this works. The court said, the point of this rule is to prevent you from, you know, getting a notice from the IRS to examine your 2015 return, completing that, and then having the service out of the blue come back and say, oh, we want to look at 2015 again. So give us your books one more time, give us everything, have us go through it. The idea is to prevent the burden on the taxpayer, because remember, the whole point of this is we're looking at unnecessary examination or investigations. The idea is to prevent a burden on the taxpayer. The court said, we have ruled multiple times that the IRS has an absolute right to go back through records that they already have in their possession. That's not another examination of your books because they never came back out and asked for your books again. Secondly, there was no way they could evaluate that amended return without looking at that detail they had in their hands. So you ask them to come back in and do this. So because of that, this is not a second examination of your books. Rather, it's simply the IRS looking at the records they have, and they're perfectly within their rights to, you know, look back in that data they got as part of the examination and come up with other adjustments. And so taxpayer quit whining about this because the taxpayer agreed. They weren't fighting that this should have been allowed. They weren't battling that issue at all. They're just saying the IRS shouldn't have been allowed to change it. We realize, yeah, they just missed it. They shouldn't be able to get it back. As the court said, tough luck, guys, they can get it back. Now, as you may be aware, what this points out is, you know, you always need to be aware of the risks whenever you are asking the service to go back into something. What exactly can they do? You know, and the funny part is, I hear people that all the time don't want to do an amended return because they're afraid that would open up things, the IRS would look at it. But who then also seem to believe that once the exam's over, oh, the IRS won't be back in here, we can do what we want. Not really the case. As this points out, you know, if they like in this case, flat missed something, and it's a pro se case, so very possibly there was no professional assistance in this case. So maybe the taxpayer really wasn't aware that this was missing. But clearly one of the things we as professionals want to do is in a case like this, maybe where we find something where we think that maybe after the exam that, hey, look, no, this is wrong. We should file a claim for refund because, you know, this withholding wasn't picked up or some other item wasn't there. You probably want to do a careful look at the actual year in question to see, is there something that literally got missed on the exam that the IRS simply didn't raise that could be raised? And as always, now it is your choice. Do you take the risk? Because as the court pointed out here, if you throw this amended return back in, the IRS has to go look at that data again. And when they look at that data again, they may find the problem. This was a case of the taxpayer had apparently benefited from what was frankly a sloppily done exam. But the problem was that as soon as they filed that amended return, somebody other than the agent that did the exam got the chance to look at the file. That person, turns out, knew more what of what he was doing than your agent did. And that person came up with the proper assessment. It's a risk that you always have to be aware of whenever you get the service to look back at something. That does present risk. Just doesn't mean you don't do it, but it does mean you understand the risks. That's your key issue. Well, as I said, it is now CPE time, serious CPE time. This is it. This is coming out of the last week or so that we have to get a lot of our training before the tax season begins. And I realize we have this law out there, and that, unfortunately, has probably got to wait for some January training to get the law taken care of, because, you know, they're likely to get this done just about the time that you're likely to be heading for vacation for the holidays. But for those of you who want to pick up some stuff this week, we've still got courses going. All the state societies, you know, almost all of them, I believe, would have something running this week. I'm going to be on the road. I'll see some of you guys in Boise, Idaho. I'll be there Monday and Tuesday. I'll be dealing with partnerships and the partnership audit rules, especially. Oh, yeah. Remember that thing's coming up next year? We'll talk about pass-through entities as well in general on Tuesday. Then I go down. I spend Wednesday getting from Boise, Idaho to Miami, Florida, getting to Miami. And in Miami, I'll talk about real estate partnerships, which I'll also talk some about the partnership audit rules for obvious reasons. And then we'll have the update, current federal tax developments, the actual full day session. We'll talk about the major updates of this year. And if we actually had something that looks like we know what the tax bill is going to be, we'll talk about what we have. You know, maybe the conference committee will actually get at least a pieces together. And even though the House isn't voting, maybe we'll have a bill. Who knows? Then I come back, I'm done with my travels, which is good, and I do have 2 days in Phoenix here locally. In case you're not aware, I am from Phoenix. The 17th and 18th, I'll be doing Arizona Ethics and Arizona Income Tax on the 17th. Those are four-hour courses. And then current federal tax developments again on the 18th, and hey, maybe we'll have a bill by then. If not, who knows? As I say, updates on the tax bill, those we'll have here for you on this program as they come along. You know, we'll probably also be doing some training in various locations on that. I already have a tentative date in Phoenix in late January, January 26th. We're going to do a four-hour session on the new law, subject to the caveat that we have a new law. But we've already booked that date in place, so we know it's coming. And again, we'll try to work on something, and certainly at least on this program, we'll try to talk to you about what's going on with the new law once we have a new law. But until then, hopefully you'll enjoy the rest of this wonderful year in tax planning time. Tax planning is so much fun when you don't know what the law is. You can catch our updates during the week that we write up at our website, currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can also download a PDF that has all the articles we talked about for this week's developments. You want to send any questions or comments, you can send it to me, Ed Zollers at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. And also, you can follow me on Twitter. My handle there is at Ed Zollers. Most of what I post there is going to be information related to the developments as they go up on the website, anything else that happens that I think I want to flag for you, and we'll do that sort of background. Otherwise, just be sure to come back here next week. We'll talk about what's going on. We'll let you know if, in fact, we got a conference report of any sort. And we'll get ourselves ready here to see, as we come to the end of the year, new tax bill and new developments in hand. See you next week on Current Federal Tax Developments.